Thanks. Thanks so much, Jim. I got to be honest. I never noticed you were gone. So I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I was really glad to see you back in the fold and so active as you are. It's crucial. I'm also full candor. My sponsor's on the call, so he's gonna maybe keep me honest, I hope, but we'll see how that goes. My name is I'm alcoholic. I'm Tony B, and my sobriety date is October 29th, 1990. A member of How It Works Men's Group on Saturday morning, and my sponsor is Dave Fallsgraf, and I'm glad to say all of those things because days and weeks and months before I came into AA, I would have idea that anything outside of my own head would do anything for the grief and misery and anxiety that I carried around with me. Even though I was fully employed in pretty much a job that I had designed for myself, there was just so much baggage that I was carrying around with me that I felt like there was a 30-pound weight everywhere I went. Kind of like Roland H., who ended up in the chair across from Carl Jung. I ended up in a chair across from a fellow named Paul Kugler, who's a local and internationally known Jungian expert. He went to Switzerland to the original Jung Center and studied and wrote and figured if anyone's going to figure out what's wrong with me, he will. And he listened to my tale of woe for about an hour, which I now qualify as my first lead. And his grand diagnosis was, I think you have a drinking problem. I wasn't ready to buy that. Just a little background. I grew up in Kenmore. I'm back living in Kenmore. Mom and dad together until they passed on. Extremely religious, but never onerous about their religion, but just that they had their faith and they were very pleased with it. And my mom went to church every day. My dad was close behind her, praying all the time. We worked as part of a family business. His brother started a business and he went and worked in there. And my brother, who took over the business and did amazing with it, likes to say we didn't know we were poor. But we were, mom and dad made it comfortable for us. And we lived what seemed like a normal life. There was arguing, and my dad was prone to fits of rage from time to time, but none of the emotional sabotage and awfulness that I hear from some other people that lived among that situation. My dad, like my mom, barely had any drinks. My dad liked to have his beer. I learned how to drink beer from him. He would come home from work and have two Schmitz beers from Philadelphia down his gullet before he sat down. And then he would sit in the easy chair in the evening, with a glass of whiskey. And that was his thing. But he got up every morning and went to work and did everything he took us on vacations. But I was the outsider in the family. I was the black sheep, interested in reading and the arts. And my brothers were more into sports and rowdyism. And, I found rowdyism soon enough, but I found it pretty much the day after I found my first drink at age 13. There was always enough beer and liquor around the house to poach. But it I was an alcoholic from the day I started drinking. I didn't ease into it like some people. And I would drink to the point where I threw up. And one would think like, oh, well, there's a warning sign. And to me, the warning sign was keep going. And I did for 20 years. And it escalated out of high school into college and all through my 20s, where I basically set up my world to make it completely reasonable and unassailable to drink as much and as often as I wanted, Like Jimmy, I went into the bar and entertainment industry. You know, I started out with the most amenable job to drink as much as I wanted, which was a DJ. You know, I had to put on a new record every 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. And then I could drink as much as I wanted all night long for 6 hours, you know. So I did. And I often remember coming home and not putting my head on the pillow, but I'd put on a record and immediately pass out, and I'd wake up and with headphones on, and the record would just keep repeating over and over again, or it was sitting in the end of the group. So I was in that game, and the further along in leading, I came all the way up to running these huge parties and putting a couple of nightclubs together. And when I was managing the nightclubs, I had even less to do while it was happening. I had lots to do all week long to get everything together and everybody going on everything. But once the place was open, it was running itself. You know, I had to take care of a few things, but you know, that was pure party time to me. Didn't impress the people that were owning the place, even though it was making them piles of money. I thought the piles of money would be my excuse to do anything I wanted. I was wrong. And then I sort of I'd say the beginning of the end of this whole thing, long before I came to AA, was I had a chance to start a new one after I got after I unceremoniously quit. You know, my high profile morals quit on this amazing opportunity I was in the middle of. I'd show them. Well, they kept running it as if I was never there. And I find another opportunity, and I was in the middle. This time I was a little smarter in negotiating with the owners of this situation. But again, the me first started to take over, even though I was getting the advice of a really smart lawyer. And I said, I'm just going to do this. He goes, well, if you do, then forget you ever know me. I go, what are you talking about? He goes, I got my reputation on the line, and these are high profile people. And if it's known that I advised you on such an awful deal that these guys are handing you, I don't want any part of it. And it's the first time I ever listened to someone other than my impulsive brain in my adult life. And I got a deal that was unbreakable if they just decided to close the bar, collapse the organization. The owner of the company gave me a personal guarantee for a severance, so I had my protection that I didn't have in the first place. And with that, and I was tapering off a little bit in that year between one bar and the other. But as soon as the bar opened, I went right back to it. You know, I didn't know what I didn't know. And they said, if you put it away and then go back, you're just right where you were as if you never stopped, only worse. And that's exactly what happened. And it scared me because one night I drove from the place, which was in Allentown, to behind the be into Delaware Park in a complete blackout. You know, I remember being in the bar. The next thing I remember was waking up in my car as the sun rising, and thinking like, oh, well, that happened. Like nothing out untoward, but it started to scare me, and that's what led to the meeting with the young guy, which would lead to more counseling. And my habit was, where they say we need to be of service in AA. Well, I was of service when I was not in AA. It just wasn't the kind that anyone cared about. You know, my service was looking at any one of you and telling you what your problem was and how to fix it. So when I got to a point where my friend said, I can't counsel you because we're friends, here's the name of a guy and go see him. And I did. And I was living with someone at the time. This is the second male-female relationship I was in while I was drinking. I wouldn't say that it was anything of a partnership, because in this case, we both had our situation. She was way more into drugs than I was, although I wouldn't say no to any drug, pretty much, if you handed it to me. I wasn't going to go out and be spending the piles of money that she was to get that kind of stuff in her brain. But I immediately said, you need to come with me on this. We're gonna do this together. We went, but neither of us tapered off our in our addictions. And the counselor just looked at me and he smiled, this old guy, and he goes, I don't even know why you come and see me. And we're like, what are you talking about? He goes, well, I'm like a Band-Aid, and as soon as you walk out of the office, you rip it right off. So what's the, and I can still see this guy nodding his head like this, going, you should just try a meeting. Go to a meeting. That was the guy that pushed me in the doors of AA. So I finally walked in the doors of AA, and I felt a welcome from the first time I walked in, because the guy greeting was a guy that I used to party with. And I mean, this guy was like in the scene, and like he was either your best friend or your worst enemy, because he would be the guy that would collect for drug dealers if he needed to. So you didn't want this guy on your bad side, but if he was on your good side, it was party central. So we had a good relationship because I was on the scene and he knew me, and we had our fun times together. But I'm thinking, this guy's in ahead of me. Wow, I'm what? What's that all about? And then his sister was giving the lead inside, and I knew some other young people in there, people my age, in their 30s. And I thought, wow, this isn't as this isn't as weird as I thought it was going to be. And it was at St. John's Grace, and I lived, I won't go into the story how I got there. It's a long, silly story, but it was, I was looking all over in the newspaper and the meeting books and whatever. And I didn't realize, I lived on Bidwell near Elmwood, and didn't realize that there was like 12 meetings within shouting distance of me. But anyway, I found St. John's Grace, and Sunday Nighters became my home group. And I didn't get the white light like other people did. My path into sobriety was quick, slowly, not quickly, of the educational variety, as they say. But I made use of people in AA almost immediately. My relationship with the person that I was living with went south pretty quickly when she saw I was truly serious about putting it down forever and getting sober. And the other thing is, I had one bit of huge bit of grace in that I had no compulsion. The obsession to drink left me almost immediately. And I don't take it lightly, but I say sometimes that maybe because of my dad and another friend of mine who early in my drinking before here's an AA, here's an alcoholic talking. Early in my drinking before it got really, really bad, I used to drink 12 packs every night with a friend, or 8 packs with a friend of mine in his basement. So, that's an Olympic sized drinker talking that I've heard so many meetings. I kind of feel like the obsession to drink left me, because when I hear people say, yeah, just one sip or one drink would be okay, I'm thinking, you've got to be kidding me. I needed six to really get the party starting. So I think I recognized that I was in trouble after my third or fourth beer. So I thought, why bother? And I never went back to it. And I know it's a lot of grace to have that happen, and I'm truly grateful. So I got active in Sunday Nighters. I did what they said. I don't know if I fully made 90 and 90, but I met a lot of friends. Went to the convention that year. Like I said, I got on the phone. I met Chuck B. I met a few people that aren't around anymore. And eventually I met Bill Lyons to be my sponsor, who, I have this right in my kitchen from his memorial service. It's a rock-ribbed, sullen guy, but knew the program through and through and lived it 110%. And he was not the educational variety of sponsor, but he was the example of examples. And he was my guy right up until he passed on. It's going on 10 years now, and I think of him often, and I am in touch with one of his beautiful daughters, watching this amazing family that she's raising. But he got me in and got me straight. I fell in with he goes, oh, you should check out, he's the guy that said after a year, he goes, you should probably start going to the step tables, you know, at least get away from the beginners. You may want to hear what the steps have to say. And then he said, you may want to go and check out these people in South Buffalo at the Abbott Men's Group. They may have something to tell you. And they like to say at Abbott Men's, we love you until you love yourself. And you just have to understand what their kind of love is all about. But they were the ones that introduced me to a retreat. And that was really a path to me deepening my sobriety in a big, big way. It was a place where I became, after a couple of years, became active in the service group to make it happen. And, you know, eventually I got with Bill to my fourth step. And my first fourth step was a woe is me autobiography. It was silly. And, you know, he, like Jim said, he didn't berate me. He just said, oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's a start. Keep at it. He didn't say, no, you want to do this, that, or the other thing. He never said, let's sit down with the columns. Let's sit down. It was just a guy that said, you keep at it, and I'll tell you when you're hitting it. But at the retreat, and I also then got in at tables and heard other people and had the Hazelden books, the grids, the graphs, the Excel sheets, and tried a lot of different things, and none of it was working. And I said that at a meeting, and a guy who I saw once and never saw again said, look, if you're not getting a step, you got to go back. And there's where the beginning of my connection to a higher power came in, because you know, I thought, because of the deep religious background of my mom and dad, I had a pass. I got to audit that class. But it wasn't true, because the truth is, I avoided it at all costs. As soon as I was old enough and took over the paper route that my two brothers had ahead of me, which delivered the courier in the morning, I delivered the Sunday morning paper, and I started telling my folks, I don't need to go to church with you because I'll go right after papers. Well, the truth is, I went to the year host. And, you know, that to me is incredibly telling, that I would, A, not go to church, and B, lie about it and not find anything wrong with either of them. But what it told me was that I truly needed to get back and at least find some connection to a power greater than myself and acknowledge it, as step two and three says. And I did. And from there, I was able to do a clear, fearless, and thorough step four, and then did step five at a retreat, and felt like I'd made it through. And that was really the beginning of my entire journey in AA. And from there, you know, I stayed a member of Sunday Nighters as the home group. And then I moved to Kenmore after I moved out of Buffalo and found, I think I bounced around a bit. Lions used to go to this meeting on Landers on Wednesday night. I went there. I went to University Men's. And then Chuck started the How It Works group on Saturday mornings. I thought, that sounds good. So I went to that meeting, and that's my home group. I like the foundation of AA. So when I find a foundation in AA, I stick to it. You know, I've had two sponsors. I've had two home groups, because to me, there's enough happening on a daily basis that I don't need to move around the furniture a lot, because I need to pay attention to what's real. And what's finally become real is I'm an alcoholic, you know, and we're a different class of people. And I don't say that in a way of being special or calling it out. It's necessary to say that. I hear once in a while, people that get a hold of say, "Oh, these steps are good. They would be good for everybody." And I said, "Well, the principles under the steps are ancient, but these steps are not good for everybody. They're only good for people like us." It's people like us that have confused the fact of our drinking with some lapse of morals, some lapse of discipline, there's like every once in a while the rock star dies from overdose or addiction, and they go, "Oh yeah, that life really took him over." I go, "No, it wasn't the life. The life, like my life, made it gave him an easy pass to drink and drug as much as he wanted. He would have done it regardless. And he may have died. He may have found AA. He, you know, maybe if he wasn't so famous, he would have found AA and it would have made a difference for him. But he was an alcoholic before he became famous. I'm sure of it. As I was an alcoholic before I realized the bar business was going to give me the cover that I wanted. So I keep coming to meetings and, I did whatever I could to be a service, but I also believe strongly in life on life's terms. And this may sound a little like heresy, but I once in a while say to people, I didn't get sober to be a member of AA. I became a member of AA to be sober. And AA and the book and the steps, that's my foundation. And even that didn't come quickly. You know, I was here 4 years before I had a different kind of white light moment, if you want to say. I was sober. I was going to meetings and I was working the steps. But as life happened to me when I was drinking, I say every few years I go through this cycle of working toward getting, achieving, having, overdoing, and losing. You know, so I was felt like I was in a slow, gray version of that in AA, where my sobriety started to gray out, and it was subtle, and I didn't know what to do. And for whatever reason, I didn't seem to bring this up at meetings. But I was at a meeting one Saturday afternoon, and there was a kid there, a teenager, from rehab, telling this story about how she and her buddy. We're going to be sober pals. We're going to conquer the world together as sober people. We're going to get out of rehab and make our get on the right track and do it right. Don't you know she shows up at a meeting and her friend's not there, and she calls her friend and she doesn't hear the call, and eventually she realizes this person is not going to be with her and she's alone, and she leaves the meeting, and that night she goes home and. In the middle of the night, she bolts up straight in her bed and just cries out, "Oh my God, I'm an alcoholic." And that just kind of burned into my brain. And I'm thinking, like, here I am, you know, 4 or 5 years sober. I put all this time in and I'm just going to go casual now, going to set it aside and go, "Okay, yeah, good, I did that. Wasn't that great?" And this teenager got this revelation. I want that. I want what she has. And I walked home, went home from the meeting. It was like an afternoon meeting, and I said, "I'm just going to take a nap." And it was like the end of the fifth step. I woke up. I took a nap at like 2:30, and woke up at 11:30 at night. And it was dark. And I looked around, and nodded my head and said, "Yeah, I'm in. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm these steps." Have meaning for me. They have a foundation for me. I don't have to ask anymore. I don't have to wonder anymore. I don't have to think anymore. I only have to deal with what's right in front of me. You know, I strongly believe in what Dave likes to say on a that we wake up with a fresh case of alcoholism on a daily basis. And what that means to me is that the and I'm getting to this point about what I'm realizing about, you know, and I'm like a more agnostic around higher power, but I believe immensely in a power greater than myself because I'm here. And I believe what they say at the end of the how it works. No human power could have relieved her alcoholism. And they say God will do, God couldn't would if he were son. I know that a power greater than me can and will when he is th when that power is sought. And I believe the steps are blinding simple in that. And there's only two things that are going on in the steps. Get connected to your higher power and take action. And that started to come to realization with me in the stark and frank terms that were spoken at Abbot Mens once. They said, "Well, how do I know if I have a power greater than myself? How do I know if I've done steps two and three?" And one smart guy would look at them and say, "Well, you would be sitting at a table with a blank sheet of paper in front of you and a pencil, and you're about to write your fourth step, and you don't have any questions about whether you should write it. You just know you have to do it." That's how two and three came in. And to me, I think how I got step two initially without knowing it was that I got step one, and I was living step one. I wasn't drinking on a daily basis because every time I thought about it, I go, "Oh no, I'm powerless." And I often say this with amusement, but to me, it's a deeper truth. And this is again why I feel like we're alcoholics and we're different than others, even those that are heavy drinkers and are complete assholes in life. We still aren't in their world to call them. They have to call it themselves and make the decision. But that we would, and they said, you swallowed huge chunks of truth about yourself when you've done four and five. And you think, well, gee, that's a lot. That's kind of a gut-wrenching activity. I should be ready to jump right out in the world and let the world know and blast open the door and say, "I'm cured, I'm better, I'm here to right all my wrongs." And they, "Oh, wait a minute, just hold off." And they put it in six and seven. What the hell is that all about? And they make it a mystery in the big book, like, "Oh, the mysterious two paragraphs." Oh. Well, it's simple if you pause and get out of the way, and it's really about willingness and humility. People like us would say, "Yeah, I swallowed those big chunks of honesty about myself. How great am I?" No, they go, "No, that's not what it's all about." They're telling you that those defects haven't disappeared. Your awareness of them has gone up. That's all. Now, are you really willing? And then you got corrected or cleared up when you shared it with another person who has more experience and understanding and shared some examples from their lives. But finally, the kicker is this act of humility, which many of us, I know I didn't have. I had none of it. I thought people that were humble and helpful were, the Ned Flanders of the world, the losers. I think differently now, and this step showed me. And what eight and nine finally became, because I thought this whole thing, again, my Catholic upbringing was confession. It was confession. It has nothing to do with confession. It has to do with right sizing everything we've done and do and accepting it. Yeah, that defect was so out of size with how it should have been acted on that other person. And the only way you could right size it is ask that person and have a conversation where it's not staged, it's not pre-planned, it's not deceptive, it's not sin of omission. It's just like, yeah, that time when I did that, I was an alcoholic drinking, and it was completely improper, unfortunate, and I apologize. Is there anything I can do about it? And what I've been told is the only act following that is silence. And that to me is the beginning of having human conversations with people on any reason, on anything, that you don't go into conversations with, "I know how this should end up, and I'm not going to give up until it does." That's the opposite of how we're being taught to live, to be of service to others. That's the other thing in the third and seventh step prayer. They're asking, we're asking our higher power to clear us up. But why are we having this power to clear us up? So we could be of service to others, so we could be an example to others. So then we take more action in 10, now that we understand how to do, right size our defects, we do it on a daily basis as needed, but they give us one more shot at connecting with our higher power at the highest level by adding meditation in. And I gave a lead on step 12 at the retreat this year. And what I noticed was that steps 1 through 11 all start with an action word. But step 12 is basically a requirement. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So it's a checkpoint. Have I had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps? Once again, here's an easy answer. Are you doing what they're saying at the rest of the steps? Help another alcoholic and practice these principles in all our affairs. And if you're not sure, talk to your sponsor. Go ask somebody. Maybe I'm making it too simple. I don't know, but it's how my makeup is. I got to do what I got to do. It's what I do for people in my consulting practice. I take complicated problems and start to simplify them, but look at consequences to see if we made it too simple or not. But I truly believe that the steps are made up of these two energies. Get with your higher power and take action. They've said it enough. Faith without works is dead. So what's the point of finding faith if you're not using that faith to do what we were disconnected from as drinkers? They say you don't walk in on a winning streak. I haven't ever heard someone say that, I was drinking as much as I could and my life could not have been better. Haven't heard that one yet. And it gets clearer every day that how it even seemed normal and rational was because of the how drinking altered my mind. And they talk about that in the 12 and 12 on step 8 or 9. Like, why do this? Why bother to go out and right these wrongs with other people? And they said it will probably uncover the pattern of habits that I live my life with. That it seemed completely rational to me to do that thing to that person while I was drinking. And by hearing from that other person as like, that was kind of rough, but I hadn't thought about it, so everything's cooler. Why are you even calling me? Or here's the best one for a meeting full of men. Should I go after and make amends to all those women that I had sex with? Sponsors going, I don't think so. You may want to check your motives on those. I didn't. I went to a few key people that I truly hurt. That was very clear that I truly, truly hurt these people. And came up on the other end, and I'm here to talk about it. And it's and the rest of it is get active in your groups. These groups fall together, and our friend Mark Fisher here, who really took this group over. This group was crucial to me. Thank you. During COVID, I was here most every day because there was nowhere else to go. But then me being me, I started realizing, and I still do every once in a while, is I dip into meetings all over. I was in a meeting in Kansas City and Denver I went to Queens and Seattle, and why not? And what are they going to say? They're going to say, welcome. Oh, where are you from? Oh, how great. How nice. That was the other amazing thing about this society, this fellowship, that we're everywhere. We all have the same last name. And that goes right back to the beginning. This from the first meeting, from seeing that guy greeting me, that I thought, I'm surprised he's here. And like Jim said, I didn't bring Jim any judgment when I saw him on his way back. I didn't, that wasn't me, Jim. Sorry. That was AA greeting you. AA taught me how to do that because before I would have thought like, oh, here comes this loser. Let's see if he lasts a week and a half. You know, that would have been Tony. But that's the other thing I've learned is that if Tony is talking to another alcoholic, they better go find someone else. If I'm only channeling the words and thoughts and principles of the steps, the big book, and anything else that AA has to offer, that's the best I can bring to other people. That's what help another alcoholic means in step 12. We've got to accept the principle of what they've written. You know, there's all the chatter about changing, modernizing the language and blah, blah, blah. The principles, and I work with nonprofits all my adult life, and there's a lot of mission creep that goes on from the passion of the founder. Well, we're here 90 years later, still doing exactly the first act that brought this fellowship together, one person talking to another. We're still doing exactly that in every meeting. So I don't think things need to change. We got it figured out. And I'm grateful every day that I get to wake up and ask for a sober day and thank my higher power for a sober day at the end of the end of it, and that you are all in my life. I'm truly grateful. Thanks.